Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by John Rurink, Lauren Gibbons, Craig Morgan, our special guest for this part of the podcast, Josh Pugh, who has just left as the spokesperson for the Michigan Democratic Party and is now joining Grassroots Midwest. And have you already started, Josh?
Not till July, officially.
So are you on like vacation right now or what?
It feels kind of strange to say that, but yeah.
And that's why you're here, right?
That's right.
You came into MERS on your vacation.
That's why I'm spending my Monday morning with MERS. But don't worry, I'm spending my Monday afternoon with the lug nuts.
So good. So you're spending nuts here, the nuts here in the morning and the nuts in the afternoon,
right? That's right. That's right.
Well, a lot of things to talk about, even on the political front right now. Presidential candidates seem to be jumping in left and right. Give us your sense on the Democratic field and why we should believe that Hillary does not have this in the bag.
I don't think you should. I think it's Hillary's to lose. I think when you look at the poll numbers from right now compared to where then-Senator Obama was at this point in the 2008 cycle, he was in a great position to capitalize on a lot of the momentum that was generated by his campaign. He was in a great position to capitalize on sort of the oxygen that was left out there. If you remember Iowa in 08, Hillary didn't finish second. She finished third behind now President Obama and John Edwards. So there was a lot of oxygen out there. There were a lot of mistakes that were made that have been rehashed and rehashed that I certainly don't need to get into, but had a front row seat for working for OFA at the time that are not being made this time around. I think the Clinton campaign has essentially, from my perspective, on a communications and a field level and a digital level, made zero mistakes at this point. And that's why I think they have Iowa in the bag.
Well, now what about the whole things about her email, disclosure about her email? It seems like the Republicans are picking on her on a few fronts.
You know, and the press is picking on her too. And I as someone who loves you in the media, I hate to throw that out there. But really, like, I think a lot of these are stories for those of us who obsess over and follow politics for a living. And then the few of us who maybe don't do it for a living but are still obsessed, the sort of top 10% of Twitter followers who are obsessed with this stuff and just churn constantly. Once we start talking about not even general election voters but Democratic primary voters, it's just not getting to a level where it's a real concern. I mean, this to say that any of these things rise to the level of being a scandal is just absurd.
What does a Hillary Clinton campaign for president do for the map in Michigan, for the congressional races, the state house races? If Hillary's on the top of the ballot, does she drive out voters in different places than Obama would if he was, you know, on the ballot still?
Well, that's an interesting question, and that's something that will certainly be a lot more relevant for Democrats in Michigan as the 2016 election gets closer. But just sitting in our armchairs here in early 2015, I think we could say absolutely. Obviously, as we've seen over the last several cycles in Michigan, with the exception of 2006, turnout is very cyclical. And we're going to see that in 2016. And that's going to mean bad news for Republicans in state house candidates and maybe even some congressionals too around the state. I think you're going to see not just Detroit, Flint, Grand Rapids, Lansing, but you're going to see outstate turnout patterns very much driven by the top of the ticket.
Like Oakland County, for example?
Oakland County, too. Yeah, I think not just, but again, not just Southeast Michigan, but all over the state. Oakland and Macomb, obviously, the big bellwethers. But, you know, there are hundreds of state reps and state senators and congressional candidates who have districts that don't even touch Oakland. So there's a lot that's going to be going on outstate. There's certainly a lot of action that's going to be in Southeast Michigan as well.
Hillary would be an ideal candidate for the Dems in a district like the first congressional district up north, right? I mean, it seems like she would help drive out the right voters there.
I think there, and also in the 7th district, it's not just about turnout. It's not just about turning out low propensity voters. It's also a persuasion game. And I think the good thing about that sort of dichotomy that we constantly wrestle with in Democratic politics is that the thing is, the messages that are tailored towards Democratic voters and to sort of gin up the Democratic base, a living wage, paid time off from work, sick leave, an equal day's wage for an equal day's work for women, those are great persuasion issues too. More than 50% of the electorate, and even quite a few Republicans, are with Democrats on those issues. So they're not just, especially when we're going into a presidential, when we see Hillary chart out this message path, that's being done very specifically. Those are issues that are not only going to help us, as you said, gin out turnout and gin out these low propensity voters who are with us on the issues. They're also going to speak to those voters in the middle who are going to turn out to vote anyway. But now we're going to give a second look at those Democratic candidates down ballot.
Let's take a look at Josh Pugh's crystal ball here. Okay, so we have in this race right now for Democratic president Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, Martin O'Malley, Chafee out of Rhode Island. Am I missing anyone?
I think you got all the declared candidates. To put a question in your mouth that maybe wasn't there, could Senator Sanders and Governor O'Malley scrape off some delegates between now and the convention? Sure. But as I said, I think the nomination is Hillary's to lose.
That's not Lincoln Chafee.
I don't think so, no.
So Hillary Clinton gets, what, a year from now, 60% of the vote here in Michigan in a Democratic primary?
I think 60% is the floor.
Is that right? So probably she could be getting up to 70, 80, and then maybe stragglers are either undecided, uncommitted, and maybe.
I think you're going to see a concerted effort from the state party and other interested Democrats to turn out Democrats to vote the Democratic primary ballot. The reason being, that's a really important list building exercise. Those Democrats who turn out and say, I want a Democratic ballot, the Secretary of State releases that list. And those are incredibly motivated Democratic voters who are going to be your volunteers, your donors down the road, if they aren't already.
I had a question about the crystal ball. You've spent a lot of time with the Democratic candidates around the state. Give us your handicap of who could possibly run in 18 for Michigan governor.
For governor? Okay, sure. The great thing about being even in a state like Michigan, where sort of the conventional wisdom is that we don't have a great Democratic bench, is that's really not the case. I mean, we were able to put up credible candidates in every single congressional district around the state, every single state house, state senate, and of course all the constitutional statewide offices too in 2014. In 2018, I think you're going to see a lot of candidates looking at this who maybe haven't before. I'm sure that Gretchen Whitmer will take a look at some sort of statewide office. I'm sure that Congressman Kildee is looking at something right now. And I'm sure that despite maybe his protestations to the contrary, Mayor Duggan is looking at something too. I mean, look, the reality is it's 2015. It's 3 years out. These candidates and the ones that I didn't even get into are busy doing their day jobs right now. And for Mayor Duggan and for Congressman Kildee, that means accomplishing a lot of important policy objectives by working with Republicans in Lansing and Washington. So they're probably thinking, if I had to guess, maybe let's not poison the well until we get a little bit closer to 2018. You know, we do have a few more elections to get through before we're ready to have that conversation,
I think. We do, but you mentioned some other candidates that you didn't mention. Who else would you put as a possible?
You know, I think we might see Mark Totten give it another go statewide. I think that we have I think that he comes from a very strong. This is a conversation that's been had 1,000 times. But look, Macomb County, a great base of support. As you said earlier, it's Macomb and Oakland, the bellwether counties, and County Executive Hackle, Andy Meisner down in Oakland County too. Are two guys that also have a very strong natural base of support, and it's current office holders that gives them a sort of a springboard to that too. So we'll see what happens between now and then, because again, there are a lot of elections between now and then. The field is not real at this point, but the fake field in the crystal ball is full of potential candidates.
From a communications perspective, being that you were the communications director for MDP, when that narrative is put out there that, the Michigan Democratic Party doesn't have a bench, they don't have any candidates lining up for 18 when we're 3 years out, I mean, does that frustrate you? I mean, what is your reaction to that? I'm curious.
Well, and it's interesting, too. You didn't touch on this, but heading into my new role at Grassroots Midwest and working with Democratic candidates from positions like Drain Commissioner, Sheriff, all the way up to congressionals and potentially some statewides when it comes time to have that conversation. I think my experience, both the party and heading into my new role, have been proof positive that we've got a deep Democratic bench all over the state of even local office holders. And not just in key turnout areas like Kent County, the Lansing area, and Southeast Michigan, but also outstate. There are a lot of Democratic leaders with a demonstrated record of success, whether in the private sector or maybe in a school district, who have done a lot of different things and who are now maybe taking a look at getting into public service.
Well, what about the first congressional district, though? It doesn't seem like we've got a candidate nailed down quite there yet.
I think we've got, a deep bench up there, too. We've got Scott Dianda up in the 1/10th.
But he doesn't want to run.
Well, I mean, look, when you look at somebody like Scott, when you look at somebody like John Kivala, the mayor of Marquette, when you look at somebody like Jerry Cannon, who formerly held office as Kalkaska sheriff, those are guys who come from areas of the state that are not traditionally thought of as Democratic strongholds. But the 1/10th wasn't even a target for Republicans. That's what somebody like Scott Dianda does to a district like that. And so I think it's an area that not only has a lot of Democratic candidates who might take a look at that, but it's an area where, again, voters' values are in tune with the Democrats.
How big of a failure is it if you guys don't get a top-line candidate in that first district in 2016 when you have this term limit pledge that's coming up and it's a 50-50 district? You could have Hillary on the top of the ballot. I mean, if you guys don't get a top-line candidate there, what would be your reaction?
First off, I would say it's early. And second, I would say this is a very personal decision for a lot of folks. And for all of them, you know, this is a very let's not make the mistake of thinking of candidates as merely political hacks or players on a checkers or a chessboard. These are people, you know, with family lives and with personal lives, maybe some other obligations and commitments. And so to take a look at running for an office, especially from a district like that, where your day job would be in D.C., that's a lot to ask of someone. And so we shouldn't be surprised when it maybe takes some of these folks a little while to make the decision.
It's early, but Gretchen Driscoll has been campaigning for 6 months almost already.
Yeah, and you make a great point. We've got a great candidate in Gretchen Driscoll, and somebody who has a demonstrated record of success in the public sector as the mayor of Saline, and as state rep in a hotly contested state rep seat against someone who was essentially a self-funder and a close friend of the governor's. And to knock him off in 2012, I think Tim Walberg better be running scared in 2016.
So at what point do you guys hit the panic button on the first district?
And on the first district, I'm confused. We're talking about so many different things.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, Craig was talking about the first district, and you transitioned very nicely, I might say, to the 7th Congressional District. But right now, we don't. I mean, you got to press the panic button. What, fall, Labor Day,
something like that? It's really early. I think whether you look at what's coming out of the NRCC or the D-Trip, it's clear that the Republicans are concerned, and rightly so, and the Democrats are excited about the prospect. And this is at a point where we have nobody declared.
Right.
We both have made this clear. So, look, I think it's going to not only be possible, but probable for someone to come in and declare and for us to scale up very quickly up there, even in a district like the first.
I got a tip over the weekend about Lon Johnson in the first district. Is that even possible?
I haven't heard anything like that. My experiences with Lon were great. I think he's doing a great job as chair. And I hope he does give long and hard thought to whatever his future is if and when he is done as party chair, because I think he'd be a great candidate for whatever he puts his mind to next.
How do you think the state house map is shaping up for 16?
Oh, I think it for Democrats it's shaping up very well. Some of those chickens from 2010 are coming home to roost now. We've got new districts now, but
I wish we had some chicken audio.
Well, you got time until the afternoon. You can figure it out.
There we go.
So all of those that way. Wave of 2010, where we had 25, 26, 27, maybe even more new Republican candidates who have been incumbents for the last several cycles are now term limited. So we've got open seats in Dem 45 and up districts all over the state that are just looking really, really good. And even not just the open seats, the Republicans who are also not term limited, but are going to be, again, looking at maybe a more of an uphill climb in 2016 with the turnout dynamics and with Hillary at the top of the ticket, and who have taken, by the way, some tough votes that are not going to be easy to defend. I think a lot of times folks in Lansing can get lost on whatever the gossip of the day is, or the roads or the schools, and forget about the fact that at the end of the day, these votes are actually affecting real people. And a lot of those real people live in their districts back home and are going to be really motivated to vote against someone who went the wrong way on an issue that's particularly salient to them.
Even though the House Republicans have 63 of the 110 seats, is 2016 the best opportunity the House Dems have had to win it back since they lost it?
Boy, I think a lot of folks thought in 2012 and in 2014 they had a great opportunity. So I don't know if it's the best opportunity. I do think they're in great shape going into 2016. We as a party are in great shape looking at the House map in 2016.
Very good. Josh Pugh, formerly of the Michigan Democratic Party, and is heading over to Grassroots Midwest with our good friends Dan McMaster and Adrian Heeman. Thanks a lot for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
All right, we've got somebody new in the hot seat now. Gary Neert from Great Lakes Education Project, otherwise known as GLEP, is in the hot seat with his Michigan State mug and coffee.
Go green.
All right. First thing on the agenda, Gary, we've got three things on the agenda. First thing, Tim Kelly, state representative, is on Off the Record, just floats the idea of dissolving DPS. And maybe charters can take over the entire Detroit Public School District. Is that even feasible?
Well, it is completely feasible. It's the plan that's already occurring without a plan in Detroit. I mean, the district has hemorrhaged students as parents have fled. For decades now, they've been fleeing. You've gone from 180,000 students at their peak to 40,000. 5,000 students today. So parents are voting with their feet and moving their kids out of a district that is clearly financially bankrupt and academically bankrupt. There is no question that DPS's best days are behind them, and there are no good days in the future. So I think if the legislature, the governor, the mayor, if all the parties that are now debating the coalition's recommendations, the governor's recommendations, the mayor's recommendations, Tim Kelly's recommendations, if all of these discussions don't lead to some comprehensive safety net for DPS, I think what we're going to have is nature taking its course. Parents will continue to leave the district at 8,000 to 10,000 kids a year. And in just a few years, there will be no DPS as we know it.
Last week, some of the Detroit lawmakers kind of floated this loose framework of a plan for Detroit to try to come up with some major education reforms, figure out what the price tag would be of putting those reforms in place, and then trying to raise money from some private foundations to take a bit of the load off the state. What do you think of that plan? Do you think that's something that could be a solution here, a grand bargain style?
I think that the contributions from the foundation community tend to go toward districts and ed reform where significant reforms are occurring, not just the reestablishment of the status quo. And a lot of, I mean, if you look at the coalition's report, it was little more than saying, you know, get the state off of DPS's lawn, but leave $483 million, you know, on the porch when you leave. That's not real reform, and that's not going to attract the attention and support of the philanthropic community who wants to see legitimate reform.
So these would have to be some major changes is what you're saying.
I think so. I mean, a system that just leaves in place the kind of dysfunctional system that DPS has had for decades is not progress.
Now talk about what kind of progress charters have made in Detroit as far as grades. Are charter school students in Detroit doing better than kids in the DPS system?
By all the objective data, the students in charters are doing slightly better than the kids in DPS.
But only now, slightly.
Only slightly better. And so you could say that the charter choice is better than the standard default district. But it's not very much better. It's not better enough that we should be having a parade. I mean, to say that DPS students are 40% proficient and charter students are 45% proficient, you know, is nothing to have a party over. So the academic performance of students in Southeast Michigan is less than it should be. And so we bristle when people say that charters are the problem, when in fact they're doing slightly better than DPS. But the reality is they're all doing poorly.
So is this a problem then with the kids and the parents, or it's not really a problem with DPS then, is it?
Well, I think there's something uniquely difficult going on within DPS. If you look at the scores on the NAEP test, the nation's report card, we have many urban cities in this country that have high rates of poverty, high rates of single family households, head of households. We have high at-risk populations. But if you look at the NAEP scores, you have this bunching together toward the middle slash toward the bottom of scores in Boston and Chicago and LA and Philadelphia and Washington, D.C. And then way below them, you have Detroit. I mean, they stand alone, single-digit proficiency rates on the NAEP. And so there's something different happening in Detroit than to just say it's an urban, poor, at-risk issue.
But don't some of those very same problems dictate more of a school district, a district-wide type solutions with transportation, with infrastructure, with support that charter schools can't really reach?
Well, transportation is optional for all. For all schools, and do we need to making school choice easier, more accessible for families? Because there are people in kids who they have their kids into Detroit Public School, that's a neighborhood school, because they don't have the ability to get them to where they need to be. And so we think transportation is a key issue. But I think that transportation in Southeast Michigan is a key issue for the region. So we don't need to solve the regional transportation issue only for schools. We need to solve regional transportation for all the citizens of Southeast Michigan. And that includes, I mean, trying to get DDOT and SMART to play better together, work more together. But you guys know for decades that has been an insurmountable challenge. You know, the RTA, there's a lot of happy talk about the RTA, but we haven't seen yet any solid proposals or outlines for what's going to be happening with regional transit. So, I mean, it's an issue. It's an issue bigger than schools, and it should be fixed. And we would look to the mayor to be the lead in addressing the transportation issues of Detroit.
So Bridge Magazine just recently did a story on Phil Pavlov being the roadblock to getting some type of teacher evaluation bill through the legislature. Did you think that was a fair article?
Oh, no, we didn't think that was a fair article at all. There were, you know, like a lot of good advocacy pieces, there were kernels of truth spread throughout the article. But, I mean, the reality is on the teacher evaluation bill, we had a Council of Educator Effectiveness that was supposed to take 6 months to make their recommendations, and they took somewhere in the neighborhood of 3.5 years. Then a bill gets introduced in the House. They spent 18 months of work to put together a bill that finally the Lansing-based stakeholders in the education blob were satisfied enough to send this bill, you know, out of the House and over to the Senate. And then the Senate was expected to take on this bill in 60 days. You know, that's just not the way our bicameral system seems to work. We respect the right of each chamber to weigh in on the bill. And so Senator Pavlov didn't get the bill until, you know, just prior to the summer break and had to get it done during the election year. So it was expecting a lot that an issue of this magnitude was going to move that swiftly through one chamber when it took so long to get it where it was. And then the council's recommendations originally were supposed to be ironclad kind of recommendations, and they really weren't. They were a series of menu choices and options. So they spent longer than they were going to, delivered less than they were expected to, and then the legislative process started to take hold.
But then you could say Phil Pavlov, state senator, then took their recommendations and did very little with them.
Well, he took the bill that came over from the House and started to have the kind of due diligence they have, started to actually look into the bill, talk to interest groups, talk to his committee members. And there wasn't enough of an appetite to simply adopt the House passed version without any input from the Senate, which is what would have had to happen if you were going to run that bill in less than 60 days in the Senate. You wouldn't have any Senate involvement. So it kind of ran out of runway there at the end of the year. You may recall there were some issues really taking up a lot of the energy in terms of getting Proposal 1 together at the end of the session. And so they came back at it and started fresh. And he's shown the leadership and initiative to start this session with a bill. It's Senate Bill 103, so it's one of the earliest bills introduced in the Senate, and it is structurally very similar to the House-passed bill. It just has some fewer bells and whistles in it than the House-passed version.
It pushes more control to the locals.
Well, it leaves more options to the locals. I mean, you know, it is state law today that teachers have teachers be evaluated every year. So this process is happening today. And many school districts have found a way to develop an evaluation process that works for them. And if you've already invested time, energy, and money into a system that meets the criterias of the legislation, then why should that be disrupted? It shouldn't be.
Did GLEP support the evaluation bill last session?
Yeah, GLEP supported the moving the version of the bill through the House committee, and we very specifically said, I mean, we had a number of very high-level concerns with the bill. Those the highest-level concerns were addressed. The mid-level concerns were not yet addressed. But we did advocate moving the bill so that we could move this down the track. We were under this deadline that we're already behind, you know, current state law, and we're supposed to have been evaluating teachers based on growth, but don't yet have a growth model in place in state law. So we have to do something, change the date of when we have to start evaluating teachers or pass a bill. So we were supportive of moving the bill. We were also supportive of moving the bill in conjunction with passing Representative Lund's bill on performance pay. And our letter to the legislature in support of the bill said that it was specifically support in conjunction with passing performance pay, which did not happen.
One of the allegations in the Bridge article, which it sounds like you've read maybe a couple times, was that Senator Pavlov was kind of the lone person blocking this reform. You talk to lawmakers all the time. Were there enough votes in the Senate to get that bill passed?
Well, I think that was one of the chief issues with the article is that there's a reference in the article that said Senator Pavlov was alone and 27 senators were prepared to vote for that bill, and that he single-handedly thwarted that effort. Now, I mean, I know some of the people at Bridge. They don't spend a lot of their time up here in Lansing, but I can guarantee you if 27 senators agreed on something, it would happen. It would not be thwarted by one person. So I don't think that accusation is accurate. I don't think the number counting, the nose counting was accurate, because you might have said in concept to senators, do you believe we should have a teacher evaluation bill? Yes. I mean, you don't get a lot of specific feedback until you have a specific bill in front of them. And I think a lot of that nose counting was done long before the House bill showed up in the Senate.
If nothing gets done, what happens if they don't pass any teacher evaluation bill?
Well, if no teacher evaluation bill is passed, then we are left with the existing law. And existing law says that starting with this school year, the current school year, that you will evaluate teachers, and that the student growth as measured by state assessments and local assessments will make up 50% of the evaluation of the teacher. So that will go into place. Now, the difficulty there is we don't yet have a growth measure in place. We don't have a test yet that measures growth. We would have had we replaced the MEEP when it was going to be replaced, but we had a one-year extension there. So you can't measure growth until you have 2 points in time. So we need a new test. We need it to measure growth. And the bill says, and most of the people in the education world believe, you really shouldn't be making any high-stakes decisions until you have 3 years of stable data. So the Pavlo bill sets the clock properly and says, once we have 3 years of data from the same test, which would be roughly 4 years from now, that's when you can start using that data. So we really need that to be done, or we're sitting in kind of an odd spot with a state law requirement that we legitimately can't really address in terms of timing. Now, in terms of the amount of the evaluation based on growth, the current law says 50%. That's a hot topic being debated. It's been reduced to 40%. In the Senate passed bill, as it was in the House passed bill last year. So I think there's a consensus that we want this percentage of the evaluation based on growth to be 40% of the teacher's evaluation. There's a consensus, but current law says 50.
Right. And then the fight gets over, how do you grade the remaining 60%? That seems to be where the fight is.
The bulk of the evaluation for a teacher is based on classroom observation, right? Observing the teacher, having the administrator observe the teacher. And so where some of this discussion has been is, does the bill name and prescribe the brand name evaluation models that exist today? And that's been a disconnect between the House passed version and the Senate passed version. The House passed version said the four models that were named in the Deborah Ball MCEE report, you must choose one of those. The Senate version says it doesn't name brand names. It says you have to have a system, it has to be research-based, you have to publish on your website where it's from. And so there's a difference between, you know, picking winners and losers or handcuffing districts to stick to models. What if a new model comes out of evaluation that is really good? Well, you're stuck. You know, this teacher evaluation based on student growth is a fairly new phenomenon. Maybe the best evaluation model hasn't yet been adopted.
Yeah, but you could also have local districts, though, just kind of willy-nilly in it, too.
Well, they can't willy. It's not about willy-nilly. I mean, it has to, again, be research-based. They have to publish that. I mean, I guess you could have willy-nilly's observation tool if someone were to name one like that, and then a number of districts may do it. I mean, we had someone testify last week in the House committee that, you know, since this law was passed and the districts do have to observe teachers, they do have to evaluate them, that the vast majority of districts have adopted one of the four models that were named by the Ball Commission, because they're the four leading options, right? I don't think it's safe to assume that if you don't force people to pick one of the four, that they are going to go to the ends of the earth to try to find something, not one of the four, right? Those are the most likely suspects. They don't need to be ordained in legislation as the winning evaluation models.
Would you be supportive of language that would let MDE pick a certain number of assessments each year? Tools each year?
Well, I think the role of the MDE in the evaluation process is also an issue of some point of difference between the House and the Senate. And I mean, we have a new superintendent coming on in just a few days. We probably soon will see how the relationship between the department and the legislature will be evidenced. Currently have the moving of the school reform office from the Department of Education to another department. And so there are a number of issues that need to play out in terms of legislative and department relationship. I think we should start with a new superintendent with a fresh slate. If only we could start with a new majority board of the members of the State Board of Education, then it could be an absolutely clean slate. But that doesn't seem to be happening.
So maybe the best idea would be to try and move some more things out of their authority and maybe move them into different sections of state government.
Well, I think it's safe to say that what we lack in Michigan is a single vision or goal for public education. We don't have one. We have a lot of chiefs and very few Braves. We have a governor who gets the blame but doesn't have control of education. We have a superintendent of education who's not appointed by the governor like every other cabinet official, but answers to the state board. And the state board, the majority of the state board, has their own ideas about education and how to get things done, and they're not in concert with governor's ideas. And then we have the legislature, which has the plenary role of our education. They seem to have different ideas about how to proceed. So when you don't have a single vision, then you can't all be rowing in the same direction. And I think that level of dysfunction at the highest points in Michigan probably contributes a great deal to the disarray that we have in terms of education. I think that's unfortunate, and it'd be great if we could fix these things, and we've long advocated that the superintendent be appointed by the governor, governor.
Are you announcing a petition drive here?
We're not announcing a petition drive, but there was a resolution put forth by Representative McBroom to elect state board members geographically instead of statewide. Would that help? It may help provide more balance on the State Board of Ed. But if we're going to go to the voters and ask them to change the Constitution, we would be looking to insert a few words in that resolution to change the appointment of the superintendent to be from the governor. So we wouldn't launch a petition initiative to get it done, but we would seek opportunities perhaps to insert or delete some words to reach a variety of policy goals.
Gary Nayard from the Great Lakes Education Project, otherwise known as GLEP. Thanks for joining us on the podcast. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Gary Nayard, Josh Pugh, Craig Mauger, Lauren Gibbons, and, of course, the boss, John Rury. Until next week, I'm Kyle Moon. Take care.